ballyhooey Hollywood, where any office boy or young mechanic can be a...
All right, it's Dave Player here on 720 WGN. So did you know that Hollywood was not the birthplace of the film industry in America? That's right, it was Chicago. So in the timeless book, Flickering Empire, it's a fascinating yet little-known story of how Chicago served as the unlikely capital of American film production in the years before the rise of Hollywood from 1907 to 1913. Highlighting the rise and fall of major Chicago movie studios in the mid-silent era, principally SNA Studios and Selig Polyscope. Now, joining us on this Oscar weekend is Chicago historian and author Adam Seltzer. It's been a while. Nice to have you back on the show, Adam.
Hey, good to be back.
You know, Chicago, and it's perfect to talk about on this Academy Awards weekend, was the capital of film production. Many people don't know that, but you've noted that there's literally thousands of films made in Chicago, really beginning in the mid-1890s. It's unbelievable.
Really, there were quite a few starting about 1896. We had a movie that was made by a French filmmaker, but it was in Chicago. It's called Police Parade. It's just about 300 policemen walking past the camera. 197 of them have mustaches.
Of course they do. Of course they do from back then. Did the world's...
Nothing's as popular today as mustaches were in 1896.
No, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Now, but at that time, and we were talking about the late 1890s, did the World's Columbian Exhibition play a role in all of this?
Sort of, yeah. That was really planned to be the place where most people saw moving pictures. Edison was working on his kinetoscope, the thing where you peer into a peephole and turn a crank and see a moving picture show. But the guy he had doing the actual work on it had a nervous breakdown, so it wasn't ready in time. Instead, there were a couple of little moving picture devices like the tachyscope on display at the fair. And also, Edward Muybridge, who was kind of a pioneer of moving images, was actually operating what was essentially a movie theater. He called it the Zoopraxographical Hall, which he was projecting images onto a screen a couple of years before that became common, showing how animals moved.
Yeah,
but he didn't think to market it as a moving picture show. He marketed it as lectures on animal locomotion, so nobody came.
Yeah, but you know what? When you think about that, that's pretty brilliant to think about projecting it that way, because I think the way you saw movies was those little arcades and stuff and those little machines. So
right.
Doing it as a group in a communal experience, that's kind of interesting that he did that all the way back then.
You figure out the story you always hear about it, and no one knows if it's true. It should be true. But George Spoor, who went on to form SNA, said that he went to a kinetoscope parlor who was looking into the crank, and while he was looking down and his hands were busy, somebody picked his pocket. So he thought, hey, there's got to be a better way to do this. And also, if you show a movie to hundreds of people at a time instead of just one at a time, there's obvious economic advantages there.
Now, you mentioned Thomas Edison. I mean, obviously introduced the phonograph and so many other things in the 1870s, but he was kind of really the pioneer behind film as well, Edison.
Yeah, certainly. He was working with, as soon as he, when he first put out the phonograph, recorded sounds, it's really interesting to go back and read the newspaper articles when he showed that off to reporters. Everybody was just astounded by this thing. Some people assumed he was faking it. They, like, brought in magicians to try to debunk how he was faking this. Because, you know, sound was ephemeral. It had just been a fact of life for all of history. A sound happened once, and then you could never hear it again. This guy was recording him and playing him back, and the obvious next step was doing the same thing with visuals. He didn't do so much of his inventing himself. He generally hired that work out to other people. But he had this knack of being able to tell what needed to be invented, what direction society was heading.
Well, you mentioned the kinetograph. What exactly was that? I mean, it was obviously strictly video, but how did that work exactly?
Well, the kinetoscope was a thing you would peer into a crank and peer into a hole and turn a crank, and you'd see like a flip show.
Yeah.
It was really just a series of pictures over and over, which of course is what moving pictures are. And I remember like seeing one at Disneyland when I was a kid that was called Dough Fight. It was just people having a fight with dough. Still funny after all these years.
It sounds funny, yeah. Yeah, but the kinetoscope, you know, strictly for video. Obviously, the phonograph came in 1877, strictly for sound. Why did it take another 25 to 30 years to actually think about bringing those two things together?
Well, people thought about it early on. The trouble wasn't so much syncing them. That was easy enough to do. The trouble was amplification. The theaters that were built just weren't wired for sound and playing the sound loudly enough that everybody would be able to hear it. That was the kind of an innovation that took a little while.
Now, there were major players in Chicago. We mentioned SNA and Selig Polyscope. The Klein Company was another one. But there were actually well over a dozen movie companies based here in the early days of film.
There were quite a few of them, yeah. I mean, it was such an exciting time to be a part of that industry. And, of course, there are parallels to other industries today. But at the time, there was this whole new industry, a whole new business, and a whole new art form emerging. And there's a line in Chaplin's autobiography that always stuck with me. When he started at Keystone, he figured this was all brand new, so I reasoned that I knew as much as anybody else did. And really, that was what everybody did. They were just making up this whole art form and industry as they went along. Anybody who could get the equipment and was savvy enough to stay out from under Edison's radar so he couldn't come and break all of your stuff and sue you, could become a mogul almost overnight, it seemed like.
But Chaplin, so associated with SNA, SNA still exists. I don't know if it was rebooted as a company. They're a production company here in Chicago, but
yeah, they got rebooted. It's not exact. They bought the name, but it's not the same company exactly.
Which is brilliant. But I see pictures all over the web about SNA Studios because the building still exists, I think, right?
Yeah, it does. It does. It's part of St. Augustine College now by St. Boniface Cemetery.
Wow. Okay. And then there was Selig Polyscope, as we mentioned, Klein Company.
Yep, that's condos now.
but then there were national players that kept their offices here as well because they knew we were the hub. So Edison, Biograph, Vitagraph, they were film companies, but they were also record companies.
Right. Initially, it started out, the reason that they were filming in Chicago was that it was far enough away from New York to stay out from under Thomas Edison's radar. Because he had patented pretty much everything to do with making movies, and if you were trying to make movies without his okay, without paying him, he would literally send a goon squad in to bust up all of your stuff.
Gotcha. Well, you know.
But if you were over this far, you could also just, like, print Made in India on the canister or something. It was kind of like the same with bootleg CDs in the 90s.
Yeah, right.
If you put Made in Italy on it, you could get away with it.
You probably could. Tell me about some of the smaller players in Chicago that were making films back then.
But most of the smaller players don't really survive. We don't know too much about their work anymore. There were quite a few of them, but just in general, it's a problem with silent films overall is that so little of them actually survives now.
What about some of the actors and directors who made their mark here in the early days of film production here?
Well, there were quite a few. One of them is a guy named Ben Turpin, who was a comedian whose career lasted for really quite a while. He was, there's no really polite way to say it, he was a goofy-looking guy. He kind of looked like he'd a cartoon character who had just been punched in the face, and he played this to great advantage.
Yeah.
And he is generally said to be the star of the first SNA film, which was called Roller Skate Craze. It's just a guy, or also known as a hobo on rollers. It was, it's just a guy roller skating around, crashing into things and falling down.
That's
but
great.
Even now, it's still pretty funny. And the one close up you can see, it doesn't look like Ben Turpin to me.
Huh. Interesting.
You know, one of those mysteries. It's said to be him, but it doesn't quite look like him.
I mean, Chaplin, again, you know, when you think about the early days of film, I mean, he was the signature name. And knowing that he was working here, it's pretty cool.
Right. They brought him in into SNA. He had run out his contract. He was getting bid on by every single company out there. He wasn't quite the superstar he would eventually become over the next couple of years. But SNA managed to win the bid, but he wasn't very happy here. They brought him into Chicago in a particularly cold December from California.
Yeah, don't do that. Yeah.
So he got here and they tried to give him a script. And he's like, no, I write my own scripts. And when he wanted to watch back the what he had filmed at the end of the day, they would just run the negative instead of going for the expense of a positive print. He didn't like it one bit here. Also, he couldn't find Mr. Spoor to give him the signing bonus that he was supposed to get. So he made one movie here in Chicago over the course of about 3 weeks, then finished out the rest of his contract out in their Niles, California plant. He told one of the Chicago papers, "I'll miss my friends in Chicago, but it's too damn cold."
Well, that's kind of what moved the film industry out west, because you could film there.
That's a lot of it. Yeah, you could film year-round, and you had an actual ocean. You didn't just have to substitute the lake.
That's right.
Had actual mountains. You didn't have to just use a hill and try to make it look like one.
Right. Absolutely. We're talking to author and Chicago historian Adam Seltzer on how Chicago invented the U.S. film industry. And there's more with him next on 720 WGN. decorated state player on 720 WGN. We're on this Oscar weekend. We're talking to Chicago historian Adam Seltzer about how Chicago was the center of the early American film industry. There were many theatrical firsts made here in Chicago, wasn't there, Adam?
There were quite a few. We started things like serial cliffhangers here in Chicago. Very early examples of color films. It's very difficult. I always get leery about calling anything the first anything, as it always turns out there's somebody else with a claim on it.
Right. Right. But there were a couple of Wizard of Oz films. I mean, you know, you think about the original, obviously, in the late 1930s, but two of them were made long before that here in Chicago.
Right here in about 1907, there was a couple of short films that L. Frank Baum himself worked on called The Fairy Log and Radio Plays. They were color films that he would interact with live on stage. These would have been way ahead of their time. And there's also a bit of a mystery. We have no idea why he called them the radio plays.
Yeah.
For a while, he apparently had a story that he had them colorized by a man named Michael Radio, but he doesn't seem to be a real person. The term radio play, like we think of it now, was still 15, 20 years away at the time.
Yeah, right. I was going to say that. Absolutely. Absolutely. First American version of A Christmas Carol, but the Western was invented here in Chicago.
Pretty much. Well, Bronco Billy Anderson, the A in SNA Studios, was in the first real proper movie, which was The Great Train Robbery. And that has a lot of notable firsts in it, too. And that was, by some metrics, it was the first narrative proper film, the first one that was a hit, anyway.
First slapstick comedy?
Well, the first pie-in-the-face take that anyone knows about, anyway.
Okay, fair enough.
An SNA movie called Mr. Flip had a good pie-in-the-face gag.
And you think about this, you know, obviously Abraham Lincoln, when he was assassinated, wasn't too long before this, but the first biographical picture about him was created here in Chicago.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Look at me. And then the newsreels. I think the newsreels started here as well.
In a matter of speaking, yeah, there was a guy named up in Waukegan who was making films of his own, and he made a film. It wasn't exactly a newsreel. It was kind of a fake version of the Battle of Santiago, a battle of the Cuban-American War that he rigged up using toy boats in his backyard.
That's awesome.
But it fooled people.
Yeah, I bet it does. How about Sherlock Holmes?
Steely Polyscope did get into the newsreel game later on, though.
That's what it was. Yeah, that's what it was. Maybe it was 1915 when that happened.
I don't know if we could call it. That's when I bet there's somebody else who had a claim on an earlier version of that. But it was certainly very early.
Got it. Sherlock Holmes, was that another one here?
Yeah, that was the first full-length Sherlock Holmes film was made here, starring William Gillette, who was very well known for playing Holmes on stage. He'd been famous for this for years. A lot of things we think about when we think of H.H. Holmes, like saying elementary, dear Watson, and wearing a deerstalker cap, that's all straight up more William Gillette than it is to do with anything Arthur Conan Doyle wrote. And SNA made a film of his play in 1916 that was thought to be lost for years until just a few years ago somebody found a copy of it in a vault in France.
Wow. You mentioned Edison so many times about, like, not trying to get his arms around, you know, his own invention, quite frankly. But he saw all these studios as competition because he produced movies himself to the point where he could sue, you know, for copyright infringement. That there was a something called the Edison Trust that came out of all this. It was a motion pictures
patent. Eventually they all just kind of teamed up and formed a trust. And it was kind of making a devil's bargain, but it also made a lot of the studios more financially viable, kept them in the clear legally. But it happened right at the time when everything was starting to change, too. Movies were getting longer, features were starting to overtake shorts in popularity, everybody was moving out to California. Well, you know, all through the 1910s and the 1920s, things were just changing constantly in films as the art form developed.
Sure, and the way it was delivered, too. So we talk a little bit about the Nickelodeon, small, simple theaters charging 5 cents for admission. You know, they really flourished, you know, for about 10 years, right in the turn of the century. And one of the pioneers who bought that up was Lamel?
Yeah, I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah. Which eventually became Universal Studios. So, I mean, you think about the origins here in Chicago. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, we have a lot of firsts here in Chicago. I'm just doing a book for a London publisher. They asked me to do like an introduction about the history of forensics. And they said, well, you know, all of these cases are in Chicago. Like, yep.
Still Chicago. I love hearing that. But then around 1914, 1915, things began to change for the film industry here.
It's around then you had World War One hit everybody in the pocketbook pretty hard. And plus, everybody was starting to move to Los Angeles. And part of it is because Los Angeles wasn't really developed as a city before then. It was still a lot of orange groves. But they had found the obvious advantages of being able to film all year, as we talked about, all the different kinds of scenery that you could get without having to fake it. And also, I feel like films were going to become so big that they needed their own city. Chicago already had its identity. It had already grown up. And sure. Los Angeles, they could kind of mold Los Angeles to themselves.
The timeless book is Flickering Empire, How Chicago Invented the U.S. Film Industry. It's available now at Amazon or wherever books are sold. Adam, you also do a lot of virtual tours. I mean, you're a Chicago history buff in general.
Yeah.
What do you have coming up? I know you're doing virtual stuff.
Yeah, I've been doing virtual stuff for the last year. We're going to start dipping our toes back into in-person tours this summer. Tomorrow morning will be a virtual tour called Art Deco Chicago. It's a tour of some of my favorite Art Deco buildings and spaces in Chicago. Then Thursday night we're doing Chicago Ghost Tour. Next Sunday is one called The Dark History of Madison Street. It's all kinds of weird stories that I found up and down Madison. These are all, you can go to MysteriousChicago.com to get the information on any of these. They stream for free on Facebook, Twitch, and YouTube.
When we were actually in person doing things, and you said you're going to try to do that sometime this summer, what are some of the type of tours that you typically do?
Well, my signature these days is cemetery tours. I've been working on Graceland Cemetery's new Who's Who book for a while. So I do walking tours at Graceland Cemetery. I do them at Rose Hill Cemetery. Then I also do some downtown called Architecture of Mysterious Chicago. I do one called H.H. Holmes, The Devil Downtown. But we're just starting to figure out what I should do for in-person tours again as the world starts changing again.
And that's MysteriousChicago.com.
Yep.
Got it. Awesome. Thanks, Adam, and enjoy the rest of your Saturday.
All right, you too.